Remarks of the President, Rochester, New York, 10 October 1952.
City of Rochester, the President of the United States. I am delighted to see so many people here today. I had a most wonderful reception when I was here the last time. I understand that the newspapers of New York State are supporting the Republicans about 12 to 1 in the Republican representation. Now going on. So I'm glad to have this opportunity to get some of the real facts and issues out into the open. First of all, I want to urge you to go to the polls on November the 4th and elect Adlai Stevenson and John Sparkman as president and vice president. They are a first-class team, a team that will carry on the splendid traditions of the Democratic Party. These traditions have a lot of roots here in New York. This is the state of Al Smith, of Franklin Roosevelt, of Herbert Lehman. Adlai Stevenson is of the same mold as these three great Democratic governors. His administration in Illinois has been one of the most able and progressive the state has ever had. He will go down in the history of this nation as one of its ablest presidents. Adlai Stevenson is a man of whom the Democratic Party can be and is extremely proud. I also want to urge you to send to the Congress two men who will uphold the great traditions of New York democracy, John Cashmore for the United States Senate and Victor Kupenbacher for the House of Representatives. Adlai Stevenson will need the support of men like these in this critical period. Now, I've been on a trip all across the country talking to the people, trying to put a lot of facts into the record. The Republicans in this campaign are telling more half-truths, more deliberate, unvarnished lies than in any other campaign in my recollection I can remember. Now, the Republican candidate for president hasn't even tried to talk about the issues. Instead, he's gone around the country putting out a smokescreen to hide the issues. He's shouting about... Just give me a chance, I'll pour it on. He's shouting about corruption in government when he knows that only a tiny fraction of the government's 2.5 million employees have even the slightest taint of corruption on them. And he knows that the corrupt employees have been fired, have been tried and convicted where the laws have been violated, and he knows that we have reorganized the government and reduced the number of patronage jobs. He's gone around the country making these loose charges about communism in government. He knows better than that. He knows that for years the government has had an effective program to keep the communists out of the government service. In the end, the people are not going to be fooled by a campaign of lies. They're not going to be taken in by a smokescreen campaign. In the end, they're going to vote on the issues as they always have. They're going to demand that the Republican candidate take a stand on the issues. and that will be fatal to the Republican candidate. He doesn't know anything about most of the issues. He's been a military man all his life, and his speeches show that since he left the Army, he hasn't even attempted to master the complex problems of civil government that he would have to face as president. The Republican candidate did take a stand on one issue, and that's what I want to tell you about today. Along with being in favor of honesty and against sin, he's in favor of the expansion of American industry. He's taken a firm and unequivocal stand in favor of building up our economy. And that, he says, requires a wholly new climate in Washington. That sounds as if the idea of a growing and expanding economy was a new one to him. It sounds as if someone had just told him about it. What kind of an economy, I wonder, does the man think we have? An expanding economy has been the central objective of the Democratic Party throughout these post-war years. Our achievements in the expansion of the economy are some of our proudest achievements. There has never been anything to equal them in the history of the world. The Republican candidate has shown that he has no understanding at all of what's been going on in our economy. Our total national production is now $336 billion a year, almost three times what it was in 1932, and twice what it was in the peak year of the Republicans, 1929. And that's after making adjustments for price changes. In other words, the production of our economy has grown as much in the last 20 years under the Democratic administration as it had grown in the whole history of the Republic up to that time. And yet, the Republican candidate says we need Republicans to revive the American economy, its inherent power to grow. That's just poppycock. Right now, the American economy is adding to its productive plant at the fastest rate in all its history. Private capital is investing in new plant and equipment at the rate of about $30 billion a year. Think of it, $30 billion a year. That indicates the response of private enterprise to a climate in Washington that has never been more favorable to it. All this growth makes this country much stronger in case we ever had to defend ourselves against communist aggression. But these new plants will also be a tremendous resource when the defense program tapers off. They can be used for making all the things we need that we haven't been able to make in the last 2 years because of the defense program. Now, just why do the Republicans want to change the climate in Washington that's bringing about the greatest industrial and expansion in the history of the world? I'll tell you why they want to change the climate. The Republicans don't like the way the benefits of our prosperity are distributed. They want to see more of the profits of the American enterprise go into the dividends of the big corporations and less of it into the pockets of the working man, the small businessman, and the farmer. Now, my friends, that is the issue, pure and simple. They want to rewrite the tax laws to give the breaks to big business. They want to rewrite the price control law to let the speculators make a killing. They want to rewrite the labor laws to make them even more biased against labor than the Taft-Hartley Act already is. That's what the Republicans mean when they talk about a change in Washington. But they're completely short-sighted about the whole issue. They're still as short-sighted as they were in the Republican 1920s, when the whole object of the government policy was to help the rich and the privileged. The thing the Republicans have never understood is that when only big business is helped, the country as a whole is hurt. Eventually, big business and everybody else is dragged down in the General Depression, which happened in 1929. You don't have to have a prosperous country unless the little man, the farmer, the worker, the small businessman is well off too. And when the little man prospers, big business gets along just fine. We have proved that point over and over again since World War II. At the end of the war, the Republicans hooted at the whole idea of having 60 million jobs. We have now have more than 62 million people employed at good wages. Farm prices and farm income are high. This is good for the farmers and for the workers. It's good for the shopkeepers and the salesmen and everybody else who has things to sell. And what about the corporations? Believe me, they're doing all right. Corporate profits before taxes in 1950 were almost $40 billion. And last year, they were $43 billion. That's more than four times the profits earned in 1929, the peak year before the Republican Depression. And it compares with a net loss of $3 billion in 1932, the bottom year of the Republican Depression. Even after taxes, corporations made $21 billion in profits in 1950 and $19 billion last year, more than double the 1929 earnings. The Republican candidate can't deny we've been having prosperity with a Democratic climate in Washington. So he resorts to the false charge that we have what he calls war prosperity created by the defense program. That answer to that is very clear. All he has to do is to look at the figures for 1948 and 1949 and 1950 before the defense program got underway. We were breaking all kinds of records in 1950. And I just want to remind you that the period after World War II, when this present so-called bungling administration was in office, was the first time in our history that a major war has not been followed by a depression. It's just plain dishonest for the Republican candidate to overlook these facts. Now, I know that many of you are concerned about what's going to happen when the defense program tapers off. Well, will there be jobs to take up the slack? Nobody knows, of course, exactly what lies ahead of us, but this much I will say to you, there can be jobs to take up the slack when the defense program drops away. It may not happen if your government follows the wrong policies, but if you have a government that follows the right policies, our post-defense economy can boom to even greater levels than those we now enjoy. I say that with confidence because I am aware of all the peacetime work that has been piling up while we've been building up our defenses. This work will still need doing as fast as money and materials become available again. And in the aggregate, this work should more than counterbalance any cutbacks in defense that we can now foresee. Ultimately, of course, the reason we can look forward to future economic growth rests in our solid and expanding consumer markets based on the full employment policy. These markets will grow as population grows, and it is rising fast. With proper programs to help assure good incomes for our workers and our farmers, with more and better Social Security, minimum wages, farm price supports, and other measures, we can be confident that our consumers will have funds to buy what we produce. For all these reasons, I am confident we can keep full employment, keep our country growing, and need suffer no depression if and when the defense effort slacks off. But I am just as sure that these things will not come about unless our national government is dedicated heart and soul to a national policy of continuing expansion and full employment. You cannot count on that kind of a government from the Republican Party. The Republican Party is controlled and dominated by big businessmen. To them, full employment is something that's perfectly all right if it just happens, but not something you get terribly concerned about. They don't believe in using, or do they know how to use, the powers of government to keep this economy on an even keel. They let you down in the 1930s before you sent your great governor, Franklin Roosevelt, down to Washington. They'll do it again if you give them a chance. The Democratic Party, on the other hand, is committed to a policy of full employment. It is made up of ordinary people to whom full employment is a matter of bread and butter or life and death. The Democratic Party has achieved full employment in the difficult post-war years. It understands a basic economic fact that to have full employment, the government has got to concern itself with the little man, with the farmer, the worker, and the small businessman. The Democratic Party is not going to let you down. Now, you people are the government. The Constitution says that the power of government is in the people. They exercise that power when they go to the polls to vote. It's your duty to familiarize yourselves with the record of the Democratic Party in the Congress and the record of the Republican Party in the Congress, and then decide which, in your judgment, is the best party to have in control of your government for the next 4 years. I'll leave that to the record. If you read the record, you can't do but one thing, and that's to send Adlai Stevenson to the White House. If you give me a chance, I'd like to introduce my daughter, who's my greatest asset.